Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Harkov, senior contributing editor and diplomatic reporter for the Jerusalem Post, and I am here with Tamar Bayeri, managing editor of jpost.com. I'm here subbing in for editor-in-chief Yaakov Katz, who's not with us this week. And we have an exciting week of news. But let's start with the life expectancy rate for an Iranian scientist is plunging lately.
I think that the average life expectancy has dropped by, you know, at least 20 years. Though I have to say that the scientist that we've seen, you know, mysteriously dying, who, you know, we have yet to understand exactly what reasoning is behind it, though, of course, we can speculate, are all pretty experienced and veterans in the field of...
True. But I expect any day now a foreign source, quote unquote, because, you know, in Israel, the military censor won't allow any of these things. But I expect the New York Times, or sometimes it's even the Jewish Chronicle in England or someone like that, to publish an article about how these assassinations went down. And probably saying it's the Mossad. That would be my guess. I'm not saying the Mossad told me anything.
Well, I mean, I think that it's fair to say that from our experience in covering Israeli news, like,
yes,
this isn't the last or the first time that we're seeing this kind of thing.
Yes. And then, you know, Prime Minister Bennett has been saying for a while now, but he suddenly started saying it like every other day, that he wants to hit the Iranian octopus in its head, no longer hitting its arms, meaning that instead of Israel striking at proxies like Hezbollah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad, that they just want to hit Iran itself. So, I mean, that's what it looks like.
It looks like that's what's beginning to happen, right?
Right.
I think that also, like, speaking of, you know, our tensions with different Middle Eastern entities, I think the arrival of the Karish gas rig has been a source of big debate right now.
Yeah. So just to give people background on this, so the Karish gas reservoir, it's like across from Haifa. And it's like borders on this sort of triangle of territory in the sea that Israel and Lebanon have had a dispute over for a really long time. So in 2011, Israel and Lebanon each sort of submitted a map of like which area of the sea they view as belonging to them. And they've not submitted any new maps officially ever since, right?
So naturally, those maps were not synchronized with one another prior.
Right. But it's not a huge territory. And Israel has managed to, you know, since then, as we know, extract a lot of gas from the sea in other areas. And Karish is close to that triangle, but not within it. Lebanon is a basket case and is a failed state, and unfortunately, and they've not managed to do anything, you know, do any gas exploration in the areas that are not in dispute. The thing is that at the end of 2020, Israel and Lebanon started negotiating, right, with U.S. mediation. And it's indirect because Hezbollah won't allow anyone in the Lebanese government to be in the same room as Israelis, of course. In their negotiations, they suddenly made much greater demands, and they brought a map with an area that's three times larger than the map that they had submitted to the UN. And the Karish Reservoir is in that area of their greater demand, but it was never made an official demand because it wasn't submitted to the UN. So that's Israel's argument that, you know, Lebanon never really took this demand seriously. And also, Israel had been developing it for more than a decade. You know, there's already a company, Energene, I might be pronouncing it wrong, Energene, I don't know, that has a...
Yeah, I read it as Energene too.
Yeah, that has the license to develop it, and they've brought their rig over the weekend, and now Lebanon is really mad and making sort of threats to Israel.
Right, because this they're claiming it's a disputed territory, but the only people disputing it is Lebanon.
Right. There's not really validity being given to it. You know, I asked like a senior diplomatic figure in Israel this week, like, is anyone taking this seriously? And he said it might not be so much a matter of taking it seriously, yes or no. It's more just that there are a lot more important things happening in the world right now, and people aren't really paying attention to it. Even though the U.S. envoy for energy issues, Amos Hochstein, is reportedly heading to Beirut to discuss it.
Okay, well, we'll see what comes out of that. Nevertheless, right. I think that it's, you know, financially speaking, and currently with the global economy being as unstable as it is, a good move altogether for Israel to kind of get its gas game up, right? We're in a strategic location.
Yeah, and it's really going to be helpful for our exports. You know, this is a time in which the West, I mean, Europe is really looking to diversify its energy sources because of Russia invading Ukraine and sanctions on Russia. And Israel's been in talks with the EU this year about exporting gas. Israel needs Egypt in order to export gas because Egypt has the facilities to liquefy the gas. And then you sort of load it on ships and send it because we don't have a pipeline to Europe, which is something that had been thought of theoretically, but it would take years.
Which was the whole plan for the East Med pipeline.
Right. But if that were to happen, it would take years anyway, and Europe needs gas now. Yeah. So
desperately, urgently.
Right. So when in recent months, like since the war of Ukraine began, whenever I spoke to Energy Minister Karina Larar, she said, we can't really do anything. We can't export more until we develop Karish. And now Karish is, you know, the rig is there and they're going to immediately start getting gas out from the water. And so I expect to see Israel exporting to Europe very soon.
Speaking of which, Karina Larar last week had kind of taken a step back from her original narrative, which she said, like, natural gas can wait. We can put that on the side. And she said, we're going to get a fourth gas reservoir to Israel. Do you think that's going to change our game in the immediate future? Is that going to make the EU think that we're more relevant? Or is that just some kind of long-term?
Well, the process from exploration to actually extracting the gas takes years, but because we're already exporting to Egypt and Jordan, and we're on track to start exporting to Europe. So it's good to sort of keep exploring so that we can continue in that vein. And I think that the reason Karina Larar did this reversal, because originally she said they're going to stop gas exploration for a year and they're going to focus, you know, because they have limited resources, they decide they're going to focus on green energy for the year. But no one expected, or very few people expected, the Russia-Ukraine war. I guess clearly Karina Larar and the energy ministry didn't, and things have changed. And so she's changed her plan.
I actually spoke with a guy who works in the renewable energy industry, and he kind of explained how it's all got to be a balance. There's not like all of one or all the other. There has to constantly be like a balance, not only like in terms of effort, in terms of like work demands, but also in terms of financial input and output, because renewable energy is something that will bring in more, you know, will bring in more money for Israel in the long run, but in the immediate, it's not going to do a lot.
Right. It's not just about money. It's that it's very hard at this point to have enough renewable energy. I mean, very few countries can rely totally on, I don't think any countries rely totally on renewable energy, and almost none rely mostly on renewable energy. So like the technology just isn't there yet. It's not scalable yet. Right. And in the meantime, you know, I think it's that expression, perfect is the enemy of good, right? That you have people who don't like natural gas because it pollutes, but it pollutes so much less than coal. So in the meantime, why don't we use this cleaner energy as like a bridge?
Transition. Yeah. Right. And I think, like you said, this could be of great diplomatic use. Speaking of which, Biden has postponed his trip here after a lot of speculation.
Right. So the talk was mostly that he would be coming at the end of June because it was supposed to coincide with the G7. Which is in Europe, the last week of the month. And now they're saying that he's going to postpone it by a month. He is going to postpone it by a month. That's confirmed. And so a lot of people said, like, oh, it's because of the political instability in Israel. And my instinct at first was that probably has something to do with it, because every day now it's like we don't know if the government's going to last. That being said, when I spoke to my sources in the prime minister's office, the foreign ministry, American sources as well, American diplomats, everyone who actually knew what was going on and wasn't speculating seemed to say that, no, it's actually just a scheduling
issue. It's just purely a scheduling issue. It's not anything to
do. Right, that Biden wanted to make several stops in the Middle East, and that combining that with the G7 started to be too much. It was just too many days for him to be abroad, and that he wanted to come back to the States.
Though it is nevertheless important to note that historically, U.S. diplomats and presidents have avoided coming to Israel or you know, having
I'll tell you, like, you know, they do and they don't, right? Like, they pretend to avoid getting involved in elections, but there's just been so many cases of ways that U.S. presidents have gotten involved. And, you know, Trump invited Bibi to the White House. And so I think
at the time that he invited Bibi, he also invited Gantz, who was his political rival.
True. That is a good point. I think if an election is called, that will definitely sort of shuffle the deck and maybe Biden will reconsider. But I don't think it's certain. And I don't think coming to visit Israel, here's the thing, is like if you're visiting Israel in an election, let's say is called next week and he visits in a month, like who would it be seen as a campaign stop for? Like Bennett is not a real candidate for prime minister at this point. Like he's not running for re-election as prime minister. So right. Him meeting with Bennett is not really going to help Bennett.
Right.
I mean, it's not going to hurt him, but it's not like it's a weird situation.
Well, I mean, maybe that's the best way to go. Maybe that would be Biden's way of saying, like, I'm a partner to Israel, not to a specific politician in Israel.
Right. Although I think that Biden is happy that Bibi's not in office.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Speaking of, you know, the U.S. and all. prior to us recording, Lahav got very excited. I'll use the word excited about what's happening with the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement in Boston this week.
The mask has slipped. In case you didn't notice the other 1,000 times it slipped. But
So for those who don't know, please tell the wonderful story of what's happening.
Okay, so BDS in Boston has come out with a map of, do you remember the exact wording? It was like the entities that support Zionism or something like that they consider dangerous. Yes, find the tweet because it's epic. Oh. Basically, they created a map of all the different Jewish institutions in Boston. And like they don't even hide it. It was like one of them was just like the Jewish Youth Alliance or something like that, you know? And who knows? Maybe they have pro-Israel events. But like it was just they were making a Jew map. And it's, you know, it's always good when BDS is honest about who they really are.
They wrote, from our friends at the Mapping Project, their map and articles illustrate how local support for the colonization of Palestine is structurally tied to policing, evictions, and privatization locally and to U.S. imperialist projects worldwide.
Right. So it's not just a Jew map, but it's a map of how Jews control the government. So, you know. Bravo, BDS. Now we all know who you are.
And now we know where all the Jews reside.
Right.
So dragging it back to Israel, you know, the political instability here has just been like a rocking boat back and forth for ages now. And, you know, this week was no different. You know, at this point in time, we're right after the West Bank vote that fell in the Knesset.
Yes. So this is a temporary law that has been renewed every 5 years since 1967 that allows Israeli citizens living in Judea and Samaria to sort of fall under Israeli law in all kinds of things, whether it's that they can vote in Israeli elections or that they can be members of the, you know, Israeli health funds and therefore get cancer treatments or, you know, go to a hospital for free the way any Israeli can. And, you know, this just needs to be renewed. It's like a technicality, but in the current coalition, there are, of course, parties that very strongly oppose any Israeli presence in Judea and Samaria, what they call the occupation. And that includes Meretz and also Ra'am, which is the Islamist party in the coalition. And basically, most of Ra'am voted against it. Some of Ra'am decided to absent itself. Interestingly, Meretz voted in favor because it became this sort of coalition threatening situation where the Justice Minister Gideon Saar basically said, like, we can't run the country without this law. Like, it's something like 5% of Israeli citizens or something. If it's 500,000 out of 10 million. I hope I didn't embarrass myself because I'm bad at math, but it's you know, almost half a million Israelis. And Gideon Saar was just like, we can't run a country like this if we don't have this arrangement. And it's not like something like, even if Meretz, say, wants to change the situation in Judea and Samaria, like, it's something that should be done with a policy, not by just suddenly creating anarchy where you have, you know, over 400,000 Israeli citizens to whom the laws don't apply. So Gideon Saar had threatened to leave the coalition if the law falls. It was voted down in the Knesset this week. The existing law doesn't expire until July, so they have a few weeks left to try again, and that's what they say they're going to do. But you know what I think is interesting here? Is the reason the law didn't pass is, of course, this coalition doesn't have its act together. And we have a prime minister whose party has 5 seats now, and it's just a mess. You know, he really does not have a handle on his coalition.
Right. And we're seeing all of his, you know, the prime minister's office members who have been by Bennett's side for literal years.
Yeah.
Slowly falling apart. Just a few days ago.
Right. And those are the people, some of the people at least, who would have helped him get through this politically. But I also have to say for the Likud that, you know, for decades, Likud has been a party that supports Judea and Samaria, supports the Israelis living there, and yet they voted against this.
Right, they chose their own, you know, personal political battlefield over the ideologies that their voters voted for them in the first place. And right after the vote fell, not just that, the Likud released a statement saying, Bennett Abaita, Bennett go home, it's over.
I just think, like, Israel to the right. I think it's grossly irresponsible of them because of what this law was. And I also think that it's really hypocritical. I mean, go back 2 years ago and Netanyahu was saying that we were going to apply Israeli sovereignty or annex all of the Israeli towns in that area.
Right.
And now he won't even maintain like the minimum of Israeli law for Israeli citizens living there.
Stepped in on the podcast a couple of weeks back when you were away, Yaakov said, and I think that here it applies a lot, is politicians will put themselves before anything.
I know, and we're really learning that now. It's really upsetting. So our guest this week is the governor of the Binyamin region in the West Bank. His name is Yisrael Gantz, and we brought him on the show so he could tell us what the effect of this law not passing would be on their lives. So our guest today is Yisrael Gantz, the governor of the Binyamin region in Judea and Samaria. And we're here at a time of sort of legal uncertainty when it comes to the status of Judea and Samaria. Since 1967, every 5 years, the Knesset renewed this sort of temporary law that created the legal status quo in which the Israeli citizens living in Judea and Samaria fall under Israeli law while the land is not officially under Israeli sovereignty. But the Knesset voted down that law. I know that there's still a possibility that it might come up for a vote again and it might come back, but could you explain to us what this political situation means for the everyday lives of people, Israelis in Judea and Samaria?
Yes. First of all, I'm sure it will not happen because it's a real crisis if it will be happen, which means there is no Israeli law on Judea and Samaria, which means all the area rights of the Israel government will not be here. For example, the police will not have any rights to arrest someone, to check someone. The army will be in a problem. And even in a maybe taxes issue, or criminals can move to Judea and Samaria and the police can do nothing. All the investments that the Israel government invests in Judea and Samaria will be in problem because the Israel government cannot invest abroad. And if it's not a part of Judea and Samaria, so the Israel government has a problem to invest here. So it will be a real crisis. And as you mentioned before, it will change the status of the last more than the last 50 years. I'm sure it will not happen. And I believe the real question is about the government, the Israel government that we have, because if the government will fall down before the end of June, the law will stay in the same status at least after the 3 next months of the next Israeli government. So we have to stay and see what happened with the government in the next 3 weeks.
So I'm just going to like put a finer point on it for our listeners. So the Knesset voted it down, but it can still, there can still be another vote where it approves it. And also, if this government falls apart before the law expires in July, then the law will automatically be renewed until the next government. So, you know, the Likud and religious Zionist parties are both parties that say and mostly in their actions really support Judea and Samaria, they voted down this law. Now, their reasoning is they want to do everything to get rid of this government. What do you think about that political, taking the political logic over sort of the ideological logic?
First of all, I believe, in my beliefs, Prime Minister, he went to the president a year ago and he said, look, I can bring a government as it will represent a representative all the Israeli residents. Now, they not succeed to vote for law, and it's, you know, it's not a special law. As you mentioned, this law was in the same status for the last 50 years. So they have the responsibility to do that. Now they ask the opposition, hey, please help us to survive. And they say, no, we can't vote for this law for help you. And in my position, look, this government at the last year, let's say they didn't invest in Judea and Samaria, but I can say more. They freeze our building. They didn't let us to build. They didn't expand the roads. We all saw the terror in the streets here, and it crossed to the other part of our country. But here in Judea and Samaria, every single day, terror attacks like the Molotov cocktail, everything here. They threw stones, rocks, whatever you can imagine. So now the government call us to help them, and the coalition said, please help us. They have a problem with the coalition. So now the question is about the government, and the opposition said, no, we will not help you. You have to take the responsibility to solve your problem, and we will not let you still stand and freeze and even punish. You know, we pay the prices about the government. We, when I say we, I mean in Judea and Samaria.
So, but in a sense, do you not feel like it's, you know, we have this, the expression to cut off your nose to spite your face, or to shoot yourself in the foot, because you're possibly, there's a risk of a really anarchic, dangerous legal situation for the people that you represent. And you're taking that risk in order to make this political stance against this government.
So I feel it's like someone take you hostage and he say, look, now, if you will not shoot yourself, I will shoot you. Which means, look, if the law will goes out of effect in June 30th, and if the government will fall before, he will stay in the same status in its effect. So now they have the responsibility to take the decision. It's their responsibility. I'm sure that they're a serious guy, and they will take the good decision, and the government will fall down.
Okay, and do you think that having an election, like having this government fall apart, is overall going to be better for Judea and Samaria, for the Israelis at least?
Yeah, I'm sure, because here in the Knesset today, there are more than 70 Knesset members that the people that voted for them were from the right wing. You know, Lieberman and Gideon Saar and Naftali Bennett, three parties that all their voters are from the right wing. They took the voices of those residents and took it for a left government. And as you see in the survey right now, the people will not support in this method, and I'm sure they will not vote for them for the next time. It was experience, very bad experience. When I say we in Judea and Samaria, and we for all the country. We all see the terror attacks. We all see the self-confidence of the people in Israel. It's fall down. And now we have to solve the problem. And I'm sure the next election will be better, much better.
So I wanted to ask you, moving away from Israel to Washington, when I spoke with your spokeswoman, she told me that you often travel to the United States and that sometimes you meet with members of Congress And so I wanted to hear what those meetings are like, if you're able to tell me names of people you've met with and how do they respond to the cause of Judea and Samaria? Because I think as I have seen it, I mean, certainly Democrats are not very receptive. And even among most Republicans, many take the view that settlements are not helpful. Let's put it that way.
So I must still lose it. I felt that I joined this movement in Washington. It was a year and a half, I think, or 2 years ago, when I came with Prime Minister Netanyahu to the White House.
It was in February 2020.
Yeah, about 2 years ago. And we stayed together in the Blair House. And I felt, the first thing that I felt, that people talked about us and not with us. And it was the first time that we have as opportunity to talk together. And I felt the people, when I say people, congressmen, senators, governors, they want to deal with us, they want to hear, they want to understand, they want to learn. And since that, we invest a lot in building a connection, real connection between us and people in Washington. It's a friendly connection. And I think it's very good for everyone. We deal with a lot of issues. We can deal with environmental issues here in Judea and Samaria. I think 4 months ago, I hosted in my house a group of Democrats, congressmen, women, and we spoke and we deal a lot with environmental issues. We deal a lot with terrorists in suits, which means where the money. And as you know, United States pay a lot to the Palestinian Authority to help the Palestinian Authority. And we showed them a lot of materials that figure out what they really do with the money. And we asked them to take care of the Appropriations Committee. They bring the money to the Palestinian Authority. And we asked them, we spoke with Rosa DeLauro, and we asked her, look, you have the responsibility. Please check where the money go to. You have to figure out that it's not go to terror. It's not for, we showed them the education system.
And was she receptive to that? Because say like Rosa DeLauro, for example, not to say that she wants money to go to terrorism, but she's not supportive of the Israeli right.
100% yes. I told her, look, we will not agree about everything. I know that we have a different thinking about Judea and Samaria and the Jewish and our rights in Judea and Samaria, but we can agree that you have the responsibility to take care that your money will not go to terror, will not go to bad education. When I see bad education, which means educate for terror, educate for hate each other, and will not go to invest in place that is illegal. When they built roads in the road or building in Judea and Samaria, illegal roads, illegal building, and you pay for that, you can do that. And she said, you're 100%. Yes, you're right. And so even if we can't agree about everyone, we all agree that we have to stop the terror. And of course, we have to stop the money that goes to terror.
Are there any other issues where you found common ground with Democrats that you could tell us about?
Yes. So we spoke about environmental issues and we spoke about security because we all understand that terror is like cancer. You know, if it grows everywhere in the world, it can arrive to everywhere different. And it's a common mission for us in the United States. And when they hear about the terror attacks here in Judea and Samaria, they understood immediately that we have to stop it together because it can start here and arrive everywhere in the world. We spoke about sponsored terror and how to take the responsibility and about the money that the United States gives to the Palestinian Authority. And the last issue that we showed them that we are using the same infrastructure here in Judea and Samaria. You know, here Jewish and Arabs driving on the same roads. We all have to arrive to take our children from a daycare, for example, schools, and we all have to arrive to work. Today, the Israel government afraid to invest in this infrastructure because they say, hey, look, what our friends overseas will say about what we are doing in Judea and Samaria. And we show them that without expanding the roads, for example, no one can arrive to his home or to work. We all stuck together. And it's a common mission for everyone here. And the same is water pipes and electricity and a health system. We should convince the Israel government to invest more in Area C because everyone will enjoy from those invests.
You know, you talked about the issue of roads, and often the criticism is that these are roads that circumvent, they go around Palestinian villages so that they're not really helping the Palestinians, they're just helping Israelis. So you're saying otherwise? You're advocating for other kinds of roads?
There is no road in Judea and Samaria that only Israelis allowed to drive on. The only place is to get into the Green Line, for example, to Jerusalem. So they have, you know, there is a border, they check you if you're a terrorist or not. But on the road in Judea and Samaria, everyone drive together. There are no borders, and we all drive together. We are stacking on the same traffic jam. And part of my responsibility as governor in Judea and Samaria is to expand the road for everyone. Now in Binyamin, more than 70% of the drivers on the roads are Palestinians. So it's a common mission. You know, when you're on the road, no one knows who are you. You have to take it to arrive to your children. You have to arrive to work. So let's talk about water issues. We all drink water. It doesn't matter who are you. Now, who has a responsibility to bring water to Area C? Who has? When I went, it's called a water authority in Israel. They said, look, it's over the green line. We don't have the responsibility. So who has a responsibility? Now, my responsibility to convince the government, the Israeli government, to bring all the infrastructure to Judea and Samaria. And we can deal together because if the Israeli government will say, look, what our friends in the United States think about it, maybe they will think that we're going to annex and we will have to stop it. So they will not invest in Judea and Samaria. And I think it's a common mission to convince them to invest.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. And you've explained a lot to us about what's been going on in politics and the debate on Judea and Samaria in recent weeks. So thank you again.
Thank you very much. Have a great day. And see you soon here in Binyamin.
Thanks for joining us for the Jerusalem Post podcast. You can stream us on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure to leave us a like, a follow, leave some comments. Let us know what you're wanting to hear. And have a great weekend.